This episode, Once Upon a Weirdness Magnet, from Blue Devil, issue number 7. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we are finding our joy as we continue our coverage of one of my all-time favorite characters in comic book series, Blue Devil. Today, we are specifically covering Blue Devil issue number 7 from 1984. And my name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, folks, but I'm not doing this alone. I am once again joined by my own personal weirdness magnet, Mr. Diablo Frank. Thanks for being here, buddy. How you doing?
Hey, it's always a pleasure. I wouldn't miss it. It's a date.
And it's been so long since we spent time together.
A week or even two.
Frank actually invited me into his den of sin. I've been in his house. I survived. The walls were covered red in blood. It was terrifying.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I've got my full desk mouse mat and also a deep red. So it really pops, makes that white background on the cover pop as I've got my Blue Devil number 7 out in front of me.
Very nice. Now, I gotta brag a little. I'd call it humble brag, but I'm not being humble. Since we last did a Blue Devil episode, I attended the Baltimore Comic Con. And while I was there, I got a chance to bring my hardcover, custom-bound Blue Devil issues. Got to take them to Paris Cullens, which he was completely wowed by. He thought it was so cool. He signed the inside of them. He even did a quick head sketch for me, which was, I didn't even ask. He just did that out of the kindness of his heart, which was such a great thing. By the way, also, this is only tangentially related, but I got an art commission while I was there also by Chris Giarrusso, who draws the Mini Marvels comics that are so fun. I got him to do a Blue Devil, and it is phenomenal. So I actually showed Paris, too, and Paris was like, this guy gets it. He gets like the fun sense of Blue Devil. So I had a lot of Blue Devil going on. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I saw your piece on social media, and I thought it was awesome, too. He's right. He does get it.
Oh, he really does. Then, you know, interestingly enough, I also, very recently, my family and I, we took a vacation over my daughter's spring break and went to Hollywood. And we were there around the Oscar time and all this stuff and did the Walk of Fame and all that jazz. The weird thing was, and I looked really hard. On the Walk of Fame, I did not find a star for Dan Cassidy or Marla Bloom. That's so strange.
Well, I think Miss Bloom's passing was a little controversial, so that could have been an issue. I don't know if there's anybody there to pay for the star after all was said and done with Neron.
Oh, wow. All right. On that happy note, and before this gets any darker, we need to take a moment to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. And usually it's tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. I leaned into the artist of this issue, which is the legendary Gil Kane. So I picked Micronauts, Epic Collection, the original Marvel years, and the title of this particular trade is called This Battlefield Earth. And it's because Gil Kane drew 7 issues of Micronauts, which is great. I don't know if you've ever checked out the Epic Collections from Marvel. They're really spectacular. Like, they are really well-done packages. And this one collects Micronauts number 36 through 50, published by Marvel, written by Bill Mantlow. You've got art, as I mentioned, by Gil Kane. You've got some Butch Geist. You've got some Keith Giffen. You've got cover art by Al Milgrom. It's 488 pages of Micronauts, and I love me some Micronauts. So, full color, soft cover. Now, this is great. This is fantastic. Again, 488 pages of Micronauts. Normally goes for $54.99, but you can get it for $24.74, which is insanely cheap. So, again, for issues 36 through 50 of Micronauts, you cannot beat that deal. $24.74, 55% off on in-stock trades. Again, Micronauts Epic Collection, the original Marvel years, This Battlefield Earth. Can't recommend it enough. Did you ever read Micronauts, by the way?
I was kind of more the late end of it, although they were also doing the reprint series on Baxter with the golden original issue. Mm-hmm. So I got a good sampling of the material. Plus, I played with some of the toys because they were in the chibi bins by the time I was coming up. And I had such an affection for those comics, even though I was never like a huge fan. I was just a casual fan. But I knew I wanted to have them. And I had that sense of FOMO because rights issues coming in and coming out. So I actually can co-sign on this one because I own this material in the omnibuses. I went ahead and got all, I think it's 3 omnibuses that collects all this stuff. And I love that giant format. And I love all the extras that you get with the Epic Collections and with the omnibuses, house ads and Marvel Age articles and all the cool little extras extra stuff that you would have to really struggle to go out there and find, and they just put it all together for you on nice glossy stock. So yeah, definitely worth picking up. If you've not experienced Micronauts, I know you're a great fan of that material, and you really can't lose. The whole run has great stuff worth reading, whether or not you play with toys, whether or not you have a nostalgia for it. They're just fun comics.
I love that you shared all of that and gave an incredible sales pitch for Micronauts when really all I was doing was baiting you, because you did a 3-episode only podcast about Micronauts and then you bailed on it, and you broke my heart for doing that.
Well, the worst part is I also had episodes of a ROM companion podcast in the tank, but I just, I got sidetracked. I've got other things going on and I hadn't gotten back to it. So that's why I kept it a secret, so that I could podfade without anybody even knowing I was there in the first place.
I knew. Anyway. All right. So Frank, I picked Micronauts. What did you happen to bring to discuss today?
Well, I wanted to keep up the toy angle, but I'm often the guy who's offering the really expensive collections, and I wanted to give people a chance to basically you might actually be willing to spend the money on unseen. So I'm recommending Captain Action Classic Collection Hardcover. The Captain Action comic, based on the classic action figure, has been out of print for more than 50 years. Written by Jim Shooter and Gil Kane, drawn by Kane and Wally Wood, a legendary roster of talent if there ever was one. Mm-hmm. And containing the origin of Captain Action and Action Boy, and featuring their arch nemesis, the diabolical Dr. Evil. All 5 original issues are collected in this volume and have been meticulously scanned from crisp first generation stats and painstakingly recolored using the original comics as guides, beautifully representing a long lost treasure. The publisher of this one was IDW. It's 144 pages, full color hardcover, was $29.99 when they first offered it. But if you go to Amazon today, it's currently $39.90. But in stock trades price, $14.99. That's a 50% savings off the asking price, 62% off the competition's inflated price. You can't lose.
That's fantastic. Wow. What a great Jim Shooter, Gil Kane, and Wally Wood. Wow, that's amazing.
Now, if you actually played with the toys, you're much older than us, though. So we also
knows that. When did these comics come out? Like the 60s? Well, they said in 50 years, so yeah.
Okay. I think the DC put them out around 68 or so.
Okay, nice. All right, good call. Well, folks, for this and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you're enjoying shows on the network, the best way to support these shows is by visiting patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And in certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to M.A. Sulco, Al the Comics Guy, David Ace Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison, and some weirdo named Diablo Frank. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast.
Unfortunately, I was too busy shoving my commission art in your face. I forgot to stick a honey in your pocket to actually catch up on my back child support payments. So it's sort of a goofus and gallant moment. Don't be like Diablo Frank. Pony up for the Patreon.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for that endorsement. I sincerely appreciate it. Now, remember, folks, this show is here to represent our entire geeky community and to celebrate the things that we love. So I want to hear your thoughts. Share your opinion on everyone's favorite weirdness magnet, Blue Devil. The best way to be part of the conversation is in the comments section on our website. Just visit fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts on the show post for this episode. Then at the end, Frank and I will cover your feedback on the next episode. Now, you can also find us on Twitter or X and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. And on those sites, on social media, is where we will post images from this from this issue. So the week leading up to this episode, I will be posting different shots from here, the cover, and different things that we find interesting. And if you want, in the show notes for this episode you're listening to right now, you can just look on your device, go to the show notes. There's going to be links there to the social media that will take you directly to the post specific to this episode. So you'll be able to see it really easy with just a click of a button. So be sure to check that out. All right. So let's get into this, Frank. So we are here to talk about Blue Devil number 7, published by DC Comics. Cover date is December 1984. On the shelf, September 20th, 1984. Cover price is 75 cents, 3 shiny quarters. And the cover is by Paris Collins. Do you want to describe the cover for us?
Despite being a Constitution Day release, the vibes are Valentine's with a lot of pink on a white background. There's a frilly ribbon banner over the logo announcing Danny and Sharon's first date. It's followed by a second blue ribbon with plus our best new supervillain yet and a 1959 pink Cadillac in perfect condition. At the center are profiles of Sharon and Blue Devil staring lovingly into one another's eyes. The portrait framed by a heart-shaped box with billowy pillow tassels. At upper left is the announced villain Bolt, focusing his electricity in an upward left fist while throwing a lightning bolt downward with the right hand. At lower right is the Trickster, nearly prostrate as he falls forward, barely evading an electrical explosion.
I love this cover so much. So stinking much. There's a lot of cover copy on this thing, and that's okay. It doesn't bother me. In fact,
Okay, man, that's your kink. We'll own up to it.
Well, no, word balloons. Word balloons are my kink.
Oh, specifically word balloons. I love text all over my covers as long as it's, you know, zazzy like this.
If this thing is designed within an inch of his life, it's so cool with this, the heart in the background and then the foreground. You know, you've got Dan and Sharon looking so lovingly at each other. You got Bolt in the foreground with the action. They contrast so well with the pink frilly stuff everywhere. Talking about the 1959 pink Cadillac in perfect condition. Like, that cracked me up back in 1984, and it still does. I mean, obviously, a 1959, you know, pink Cadillac in perfect condition would be a highly collectible car in the 1980s. But this is a comic book. Of course, I mean, it can be in any kind of condition. It's a comic. So it cracked me up here as if they're, you know, they're so excited that they found this car. And I just think it's still funny.
And this is an Etsy craft project waiting to happen too. Like, I could totally see somebody either doing one of those layered covers where you give it depth, or actually getting like that sort of lace on and building it out into, you know, a three-dimensional image. It just sort of calls out for that treatment, except that nobody but you or I would be the ones buying it.
And I don't think they've ever made like a Trickster or Bolt action figure either, but you could do it. Well, I guess you could do paper cutouts. You could do it that way too. But yeah, it looks amazing. It looks so cool. And it just screams madcap goofiness, which is what this book is supposed to be. It's supposed to be fun and action together. It looks great. And man, Paris just crushed these characters. They look amazing. Like, I love the way Trickster's expression is, where he's just screaming. Just the giant chin looks great. And then Blue Devil, like, I just want to go swimming in his eyebrows. They're so beautiful.
Yeah, I love those bushy diabolical eyebrows. You'd think that I'd maybe have a tendency toward that sort of thing. How about the fact that as busy as Trickster's costume is, it could look kind of goofy, but instead it just makes it hyper detailed under Paris's pen. He like totally can sell this look.
Oh, absolutely. It's like when George Perez draws one of his own design costumes, they, you know, and you see George draw it and you're like, oh, that looks fine. But then when you see someone else draw it, you're like, whoa, what is going on there? And that's how Trickster, his costume is horrid. I mean, it's just a wretched looking costume, but you're right. Under Paris's pencils, it looks perfectly fine. It looks like it could work. He's got puffy sleeves, man.
But yeah, exactly. Paris is selling the puffy sleeves. He's selling the pirate shirt.
Yep. I love this thing so much. So good.
So, you know, I love this book from the moment I bought it secondhand at the same flea market booth that got all the other issues that I possessed up to this point. I think that Paris Cullen's designed Bolt for number 6, and he's looking like the Gil Kane version that's inside the book. And then Ernie Colon's style is what dominated last issue. So I guess we're going to have to wait for Who's Who to get a clear view of Paris's Bolt, since we've got a great action shot of Bolt, but we really don't get to see the full details until he turns up in Who's Who. And speaking of which, last episode I referenced the Patty Duke show, and then in the most recent episode of Who's Who Review, you guys referenced the Patty Duke show. So once again, we're quite old ourselves, even if we didn't play with Captain Action figures.
I want to address the Bolt thing real quick. So interestingly enough, I forgot about this, but Paris designed Bolt a long time ago. He actually appeared on the promotional poster sent to comic book shops around the time issue 1 came out. So that was the design he did back then, although it was slightly different. One of the things he did different was he made the face mask, the cowl, completely closed, so you couldn't see any skin. And the lightning bolt mask wasn't quite as ridiculous as it ends up looking. So he actually looks a lot more sinister in the original design than he does here.
Actually, I think he looks cooler with the face out, because you can tell that he's wearing sort of like new wave shades.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually, like him having his face out, he looks a little bit more intimidating. He's more expressive. I think it actually works better. He's got a little too much black in the costume. I think you need that face out. So I'm glad they went in there and tweaked the design.
I agree about the expressiveness. Absolutely. He doesn't look quite as sinister, but it absolutely gives you more expression. You can tell what's going on in the face. It gives you more to connect with than just a black blank face. Absolutely.
Yeah, and also, again, I think that the you need the lightning bolts to connect. You need it to be a mask, or I think it's actually more like sunglasses, because when it's just lightning bolts coming out of the eyeballs, it's odd looking. It just doesn't quite click.
Looks like a Flash character from like the 90s or something.
So I do have one complaint, though, and it's that Sharon just looks like girl. I couldn't pick her out of a lineup.
That's fair. Yeah. Okay. It's a profile ever. It could be any generic blonde. That's fair. Yeah. Okay.
I know you tend to like the new coloring and the vibrancy and everything else, but I'm looking at your digital copy of the cover, and I think that the slightly more subdued pinks work better in the print versus the digital version.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It blends much better in the... I'm looking at my physical as well. Like, on the digital, the big pink blotches on Sharon's cheek are really obvious, whereas on the physical comic, yeah, it just blends much nicer. And that's just... And the fact is, the colorist knew what the colors were going to look like in a printed book. So when they replicate those exact same printed colors in the digital, it a lot of times doesn't look quite right because it's not designed for a digital imprint. It's designed for paper to absorb some of that. You ready to get inside this thing?
Indeed.
Let's do it. All right. So the writers are Gary Cohn and Dan Mishkin. Guest artist is Gil Kane, so he's doing both pencils and inks. Letter is Bob LaPan. Colorist is Michelle Wolfman. And editor is Alan Gold. So I've got a recap here. I'll read it. I try to make it as brief as I could, but once again, a lot happens in these Blue Devil issues. So the comic is called Just Another Day in L.A. So we open at a hotel where a squad of goons think they've got James Jesse cornered. Yeah, not so much. Jesse, fully decked out as a trickster, pops out a window and absolutely embarrasses them with weaponized water balloons. Then the Sky Riders show up, which are guys on flying platforms, because comics, and Trickster chucks a magnet that sends them spinning off like a discount firework behind a 7-Eleven. Enter Bolt, a high-end mercenary who manages to tag Trickster. Jesse hits a dumpster hard, but thanks to a little illusion trickery, Bolt loses him completely. That's when Jesse realizes he's in way over his head, and it's time to call in a friend, Dan Cassidy. Meanwhile, across town, Blue Devil's having the worst shopping trip in history. Nothing fits, he's in a foul mood, and he's got a big date with Sharon tonight. Wayne tries flirting with a sales clerk, who it turns out knows him already, and then she makes a mysterious phone call afterwards. File that under foreshadowing. Back at Marla's place, Gopher is visited by some mysterious bookish types from the IHNCS, whatever that is, and they're looking for Dan Cassidy. More foreshadowing. Then Dan takes Marla's Porsche out to blow off some steam and absolutely demolishes it. So Sharon swoops in to save the date night in her fabulous 1959 pink Cadillac. The dinner date at Chez Alphonse starts nice and normal, which means it can't last, and Trickster has already taken over the kitchen, tied up the staff, and tries pitching Blue Devil on a team-up based on their stuntman pasts. Dan's actually listening until Bolt crashes in. Cue chaos. Flipped tables, a tripwire, Blue Devil's horn stuck in the ceiling, a dive through a plate glass window, and an air conditioning unit dropped from two stories up. Bolt finally retreats when his suit runs out of energy, but not before wrecking Blue Devil's new tailored suit. And now, Blue Devil wants answers, and Trickster better start talking. Next issue, the Trickster gets cold feet, and no wonder. Look at those flimsy shoes.
So having missed the preview story and not being a Flash reader, this was my proper introduction to the Trickster, who will always be a Blue Devil frenemy first to my mind.
Oh, totally. I understand missing the entry point. But yeah, totally the frenemy. I mean, this is a 23-page comic, and they gave 6 pages to just the Trickster. I mean, at that point, he's practically a supporting character.
Yeah, and when you're looking at that first page, the dude is so handsome and so cut. You really do think he is the hero. He hadn't even got the costume one yet, which helps because you got a cool vampire collar and everything. He doesn't look quite as ridiculous until the suit's actually on. So you can actually believe this dude is the star of the book.
And I mean, you're right. The facial work on James Jesse in that bottom right-hand panel is amazing. And his two fingers, like, it's silly how much I got into this. Like, he's using two fingers to pull back the curtain, but damn, Gil Kane knows his anatomy. It looks so good the way he's just pushing the curtain back. It looks so real. I mean, if you just show those panels without the ridiculous pants, this could be a romance comic. It looks so good.
I mean, you look at the Days of Future Past where they introduce Logan, and it's somewhat similar. You know, he wakes up in a hotel room and he's assailed by people who come out of nowhere. This kind of has the same vibe to it. It's like you this guy could be Hugh Jackman.
Yeah,
the jacked man for sure.
He's totally ripped. And you know, Gil Kane in the 1980s is not someone I would have pegged for a madcap, wacky adventure artist, right? But he does a really nice job. And this page shows you why he's not just a madcap artist. He does all kinds of different stuff, and it looks great. So I'm very impressed with how Gil Kane pulled off this issue.
But it's also funny because then he puts on the full trickster costume and he's attacking people with water balloons.
Yes.
And it really feels like this is not a good allocation of resources on the part of the people chasing after him. I really feel like Trickster is probably not worth what they're putting into this job.
You're right. I mean, they put a lot of money into this because they're hiring Bolt. They've hired all these goons. They've got special blaster guns. They've got these flying platforms. You're right. They put a lot of money into catching him. I guess next issue, they'll probably reveal why he's wanted by them, but it better be millions and millions of dollars. Otherwise, they lost money on this deal. Since I mentioned the floating platform. So what happens is, you know, Trickster's being chased through the air. They've got these flying platforms that look very Gil Kane. I mean, they look so, the technology looks Gil Kane. The costumes look Gil Kane. The faces look Gil Kane. But all they are is these guys standing on flying platforms, and they've got these two rails that they're holding on to. I don't see any controls. I don't see anything. But let me tell you, these are an OSHA nightmare, right? I mean, they're barely holding on to these things. There's nothing securing them. They need to have a guardrail all the way around, tether lines. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I would call the union if I was asked to wear these things.
I'm pretty sure these guys were at Atari Force when I was reading it. So,
quite possibly.
And Atari owned DC, so I guess maybe they got a free rental or something.
There we go. Could be. And you mentioned the water balloons. I love the water balloons. Those are gross, so great. They think he's throwing like grenades at him, and he hits them with water, bags of water. So funny.
Yeah, and getting back to the Trickster costume thing, too, his suit is so busy, and then Bolt shows up, and you've got such a great contrast because it's such a simple, dark, stark suit. And then, of course, Trickster's already been selling Bolt as, uh-oh, this is a heavy hitter. This guy is going to be lethal. I'm going to need to get help for this. So you're building up the villain, but also we're seeing James Jesse do some pretty cool tricks and having fun with it too. And I'm sorry, even though he's wearing booties, it's pretty neat that he can walk on air. That's a pretty nifty power. So we're actually pretty hard selling Trickster still. I mean, he looked like the hero in the early pages. He takes up a lot of the book. He's pretty darn effective, more effective than you tend to think of him as being in the Flash. And honestly, now to think about it, I think that maybe these appearances in Blue Devil might have helped his rep when he did end up going back to Flash in later years.
Oh, I think so. And yeah, I mean, he eventually becomes a good guy, you know, in the 90s, and so, or at least a not a villain, maybe is a better way to put it. But I think that a lot of it has to do with these appearances in Blue Devil. In fact, if I remember correctly, I think Michigan and Cohn pitched a Trickster miniseries spinning out of Blue Devil, and it didn't ultimately happen, obviously, but I think that was one of their plans at one point to do that.
And another thing that's neat is that you've got the crazy architectural and technological detailing, which recalls the stuff we've been talking about Paris doing, but it's done in a completely different way here, even though it's a continuation of that pattern. Now, it does make me realize, though, that Gary Martin's not around anymore because Gil Kane's line is so distinctive, and I can't help but miss Gary Martin.
Yeah, Gary Martin is a treasure, without a doubt, especially on technology. Yeah, I want to mention one quick thing about Gil Kane here. So, like, at this time, and this is secondhand information I learned from Rob doing the Who's Who podcast, by the way, so forgive me if I'm getting some of this wrong, but in this point in his career, he was using a particular type of pen. I don't know what it's called. I don't recall. But one thing about it is that all of his lines look the same width. You know, where a lot of times people will use a brush or something to get varying widths in their pens. Like, if you look at any single page and really spend time looking at, you know, whatever character it may be from however far away they are, the lines that make up their costume and suits and everything, it's the same exact width all the way around, which sort of cramps the style a little bit, unfortunately, because it's great dynamic artwork, but you're not getting, I think, some of the depth. And the Gary Martin was really good at giving different thicknesses to different things and really giving it depth from that. And I think that's one of the things that is missing from Gil Kane at this point.
I actually think I remember that conversation, and I can see what is being talked about there. I recognize that you do lose some of the depth, but I like that consistency. And as much as I think Gil enjoyed having some interesting inkers take him on and do cool stuff with him, I think he was at a place where he wanted to show who he was and what he could do. And I do appreciate the look of these books. I'm a fan of this period and going forward as well. But yeah, I especially in a book like this where we're so used to that, those chunky outlines,
yeah,
and like toyetic quality, this is not that. This is a whole different vibe.
Now, one of the things that does work in his favor is there was once an editor, and again, secondhand here, but there was once an editor who commented about Blue Devil, and I don't remember the exact quote here. It may have been Neil Posner, maybe. Oh, man, I hope I'm not getting that wrong. But anyway, it was something to the effect of, like, the comedy works best in Blue Devil when the art is taking the story seriously, meaning that the jokes land better when the art isn't goofy, like super too cartoony. And I think Gil Kane's a great fit for that, because Gil Kane's art is never going to be called cartoony. He doesn't goof it up. He draws, you know, quote unquote, I mean, as much as you can be when it's someone like the Trickster's costume. But anyway, he takes the material seriously, which makes the jokes land even better. And I think this is a great example of that.
we're noting the absence of Paris Collins, but I'm also noting that Bob LaPan is not Todd Klein. I'm being a letter nerd. I caught that immediately. And it's got to be a little weird for you being the JLI Wahaha podcast guy to be reading Blue Devil and seeing Proto LaPan, because I don't think he's quite at his JLI peak yet.
Well, no, he's not there yet. And also, Gary Cohn and Dan Mishkin don't write as many words as James D. Vitesse would. But there's some things that LaPan does really great here. Like, he does caption box. Like the very first caption box in the whole book, he gives it a bottom, I don't know what you call it, little phalanges or whatever. But anyway, it's representative of the Blue Devil iconography. Basically, the goatee thing points he has. That's also done in that idol head that was so famous in the first issue. So he's putting in iconography of Blue Devil in the caption boxes. And there's another example of it later in the issue as well. So I think LaPan's doing a fine job.
Well, and it's also a reversal of his chest piece in the costume.
Yes. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And also LaPan's going in there and doing like the funny lettering. So it's, you know, sploosh, and the lettering is becoming a semicircle, and it looks like it's full of water, like the balloons. And
yeah.
He does a lot of that kind of stuff too. He's having fun with the lettering on this one, where he's going the comedy route. He's kind of doing cracked over there. And then you got Gil Kane playing it straight. It reminds me a little bit of when guys like John Severin and Steve Ditko would do work for Cracked or Mad.
That's a good call. That's a good, because there's actually a great one later. I mean, I'm looking ahead here, but there's a point where Trickster throws something at Bolt and it's wet, and the word balloon actually looks like a water splash. And so it's really well done. So yeah, he's having a lot of fun with it here. And you're right. It's not goofy enough that I think his word balloons and stuff like that distract, but I think they just enhance the storytelling.
Yeah. And I wasn't really following art credits at this point in my reading and my following of comic books, but this was the first issue where I could tell the art was different. Like the previous issue looked enough like Paris, even though I know, especially now, that there's a lot of Ernie Colon in that issue too, but it still looked like the Blue Devil issues I'd already read. And this is the first time I cracked up and one was like, this is different. This isn't the same guy that I'm used to. This looks like, I recognize, and I didn't know his name, but I definitely recognize Gil Kane as the guy who did the weird upward nostril shots in all those old 70s Marvel comics.
That's true. And you make a good point. I mean, this is really the first post-Paris Collins era issue, right? I mean, you're right. Because even though Paris wasn't as involved last issue, he still had his fingerprints all over it. So yeah, this is a new beginning. And clearly, I mean, this is one-off. Gil Kane doesn't do any more after this. But we'll have to look as we progress on the different artists they get, because they got a couple of fill-in artists. They're going to get eventually a reoccurring artist. That'll be interesting to follow as we go.
And then we get to the splash page, and I'm not sure if Marla Bloom has ever looked more gorgeous than under Gil Kane's pen. And unlike my comment about Sharon earlier, you can see immediately, oh, that's Marla Bloom. You know, even though she's drawn in a completely different way than the way she would have been done previously, I still know exactly who she is the minute I see her. She looks so sophisticated, so gorgeous. I do think, though, that Kane's struggling with the other characters. I don't feel the Parisness there, and it's sort of noticeable.
That's fair. I mean, Wayne's a little too leading man. He looks, you know, very dashing. And yeah, Blue Devils, he's a little off. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. Some of it is the anatomy, like especially in that splash page, his head's something's wrong with the size of his head. And also, again, some of it is also that, again, that singular pen I'm mentioning, like especially, it's really noticeable when you look at Blue Devil, when you look at the lines on his body, like the horns should have thicker lines and things like that. And they just don't. Everything is exactly the same width. And I think that distracts a little bit and makes Blue Devil look a little further off. It's not terrible. I mean, it's not like you're going to look at this and think, oh, this is terrible. It's just, yeah, it's not quite right. And again, part of it is all we've ever seen really is Paris drawn.
The thing that gets me the most with the horns is that they sometimes just sort of seem to float. You know, it feels like they're like on a, what do they call those things? When you're measuring a ballast or something.
Okay, I'll trust you.
They feel like they're just sort of floating, and they sort of land roughly where they're supposed to be on the head, but they don't feel like they're attached to the head.
I see the panels you're talking about exactly. Yeah, on page 8, I absolutely see that. You're correct. So one thing I want to point out is a realization I had when I was reading this issue. Right on page 1, it starts talking about Los Angeles, talks about the City of Angels, it talks about devils afoot and all that. And until that moment, I never even put together, and I don't know if this is just coincidence or not, but that Blue Devil is in the City of Angels. There's some real irony there. I don't know if that
was clever. I never thought that either.
I don't know if that was on purpose or just happened to work that way because he was a stuntman, but it's pretty neat having the devil in the City of Angels. It's pretty good. But yeah, so we're in the shop. Basically, what's going on is Blue Devil is shopping for a new suit, not like a superhero suit, but like a nice tailored business suit because he's going on a date with Sharon, right? He wants to look snazzy. So I love that they specifically went to shop for suits at the same store where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar buys his suits. I thought that was hilarious. I love that. And there is a lot of foreshadowing that's going on in this scene. And also, I'll just cover all of them, really. So there's three big foreshadowings in this issue. So it's kind of nice that we finished the first six issues, and I think Mishkin and Cohn realized that the book's got legs. And so, like, okay, we can start plotting further out. So that's where we're starting to get the foreshadowing. Like, in here, there's a sales girl in the clothing store that is upset that Wayne Tarrant doesn't remember her. Obviously, they had some kind of encounter at some point, and Wayne doesn't remember, and she's upset. That's going to come back and bite him in the butt, I think, in issue 10, if I remember right. Then later on in the book, we're going to meet these bookworm folks, these nerdy folks who are obsessed with superheroes. They're looking for Dan Cassidy. They're from some group called IHNCS. And they are going to be reoccurring characters going forward, actually, for a while there. So it's kind of fun to meet them here and just see them sort of these old, they look like old codgers, but actually in reality, back then, they're probably younger than us now because people age differently now. But they're obsessed with superheroes, and it's fun to see them.
Yeah, and they're clearly like taking notes too. They're very scientific about, oh, look, this is this person. We've had some information on them. They're prone to doing this and the other thing. Let's see them in action. That sort of thing was cute. But one thing I dug that LaPan did was that they had that business card, mm-hmm. and he managed to write things that look enough like words that you really want to be able to read it, but you really can't. But he totally makes you think you can, so you end up wasting about 5 minutes trying to decipher whatever's on that card.
Yeah, I'm zooming in on panel by panel mode, and actually, what it looks kind of like Interlac, actually, but it's clearly because it's so messy. But yeah, it's a clever trick. Yeah, because you can't help but wonder what does this stand for, and we will find out in a future issue what it stands for. But right now, we're not going to tell you. And one more piece of foreshadowing is Wayne observes to himself that Danny is getting very tetchy lately, very angry. He's got a short fuse, and that's going to keep coming up and will play out in a future issue as well. So again, I love that Mishkin and Cohn feel comfortable enough that they can start planting seeds that they know we're not going to pay off for 4, 5, 6 months, which is great.
One thing that, again, might go back to my missing the preview is that I know at this point in my reading the book, I'm still not registering Gopher as a recurring character. Like, I remember reading this comic book, and he was just some kid that happened to open the door for these people. I'm just not registering him yet at this point in my reading back in the 80s.
Really? Okay. Because, I mean, he was on the cover number one. He had stuff to do in number one. But, yeah, beyond that, you're right. You're right. If you take number one off the table and you take the preview off the table, yeah, he really doesn't appear much at all. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, and as much as I tease you about it, I didn't have number one back then. I started with either two or three, so that's part of the problem.
I thought this was your first issue.
Right. No, this was the first one. That's right. That's why I have such a strong positive response whenever I see that cover, because this was the first one.
Tell you what, if you look at that picture of Gopher on page 11 on the fifth panel, if you look at his face and his hair and all, you can absolutely see what I'm talking about with the Gil Kane pen being exactly the same width on every line. Like, every line there is exactly the same width. And when you draw with a brush, which a lot of artists do, you really get varying lengths and things like that. So it's anyway, just kind of, that's a good place to see an example I'm talking about.
Did Rex the Wonder Dog have a Timmy? Because he looks like such a Timmy here.
Oh, he totally does. He totally does.
So you talked about Dan wrecking the Porsche, and I think it's important to specify what exactly happens. So he is, how's he, like 6'7" or something? 7 foot?
I think he's over 7. I don't have the horns. Who memorized, but it's something.
Yeah, the horns add like at least half a foot or so, right? And he's trying to get into a Porsche, and it's not a convertible, and he's just like physically too large to be in this vehicle. So it's not like he's reckless or anything. It's that he's too strong to handle the wheel, and he breaks the wheel off. He's too cramped to actually move his arms around to move the wheel in the first place. And then he has to put his feet through the bottom of the car to do a Fred Flintstone to stop the vehicle before he goes off a cliff. And on top of that, he's not able to see what's going on, so he has to use his horns to rip through the top of it. So he's essentially wearing the Porsche by the end of things.
That's a good way to describe it. By the way, I did just look up the Who's Who. He's 6'8", but if you count at the top of the horns, he's 7 foot.
Yeah, it sounds about right. That sounds very familiar.
So the Porsche scene, there's a couple different things. First, to me, it does feel like a little bit of padding, because like the scene of him going out and driving the Porsche and then wrecking the Porsche, there's no real reason for that to be in the story. unless they're trying to say that that's why Sharon had to pick him up in her car, but they don't come right out and say that per se. So I thought it was a cute scene, but I wasn't entirely sure why it was there. But I will tell you, as far as the Porsche driving around the Hollywood Hills, sort of like the OSHA concern with the flying rails I mentioned to you, if you look at these roads, they're insanely treacherous, right? I mean, there's no guardrail. He could easily go off a cliff and things like that. It looks ridiculous. But as I mentioned, I was in Hollywood recently and I drove around some of the Hollywood Hills, and holy crap, they're some of the most insanely dangerous roads I've ever been on in my life. So this actually feels pretty legit.
One thing that happened to me too, it's been a while since I've read this issue. I read it, I'm sure, a number of times in childhood, but not a lot since then. And I Mandela'd the two sequences. I thought that he had wrecked Sharon's car. Plus, I thought that Bolt and Trickster had been getting up to hijinks while they were in the car. So I made a lot more about of the pink catalog than was actually in the comic book itself.
Oh, okay. Because of the fact that it's on the cover, to me, like, the pink Cadillac's a big deal. But yeah, it's barely in the comic. But, you know.
And now I've got my physical copy in front of me. We've now reached the center spread. So it's time for a commercial break to discuss our sponsors.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
That was ABC, though. We're doing NBC.
All right.
So that's one to grow on, sir.
Okay.
Which shows from the two-page center spread NBC Saturday morning lineup of the 1984-85 season did you watch?
Okay, so first off, let's just go through what all's here. First, you've got Kid Video, which I absolutely watched.
I think your panel flows a little bit off. I think it actually starts at Snorks because that was the earliest show in the programming block.
I'm looking at the physical comic. I was just reading.
I know, but I'm saying that the panels are ambiguous, but because of the earlier shows are below the Peacock, I think you actually have to start with Snorks to go with a proper reading order. We can use
an arrow. Oh, my Lord. We're going to sit here and fight about this. Fine. Snorks, which was new at that point. I watched a couple episodes of Snorks, not a ton of it. What about you?
Nah, both Snorks and Pink Panther and Sons were on way too early. And then in the case of Smurfs, I watched it some as a kid, but I think I was already like sleeping in a little too much by the 84 season.
I think I was not watching Smurfs by that point either, even though I tried Snorks. Alvin and the Chipmunks wasn't really my bag. What about you?
Yeah, no, I liked Alvin and the Chipmunks. I actually had one of their records and I just liked the snarkiness of it. And I think that they played around with it in time too. Like I think they moved it around the schedule some, so I definitely remember watching it. Alvin is a stinker, but the other two guys are cool. You know, it's a good show.
You know, it's fun. I edit these shows in Audacity and I edit them faster than normal speed, so I edit them sometimes at like 1.5 speed or 1.7 speed, and you actually sound like a chipmunk when I edit that speed, so that's fun.
Christmas time is here. Time for toys. Okay, so Kid Video, I totally was into Kid Video. I loved music videos as a kid. I loved the integration of the animation and proper music videos. Plus, they had the in-house band that did stuff as well. So I was pretty reliably watching that show.
I was totally into Kid Video. Loved the theme song. I was there. Absolutely. And it was a new show this season, so it's premiering this year.
And the Latina was hot, too.
Fair enough.
So Mr. T, I had an odd fixation on Mr. T. I think I was into him when he was playing B.A. Baracus in 18 the most. I watched some of the cartoons and I definitely had several action figures. I had both the 3 3/4 G.I. Joe style one and I had the like 4 to 5 inch one, but I didn't really watch the cartoon that much.
I watched a lot of the Mr. T cartoon, although I will say Saturday Night Live did it best when they had like, you know, drink your greens, eat your milk. That kind of stuff was good. Then Going Bananas with a orangutan was a new show. I did not watch this.
Yeah. And it's live action, so most live action stuff I was giving a pass to at that point in time. But I know we were both showing up for Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think this was in airing order, because like usually the live action stuff was at the end of the cartoons, so I can't imagine they wedged that in the middle of it, because yeah, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was absolutely where it's at, and then we get One to Grow On, and David Hasselhoff's on the TV there, so you know that's good stuff.
I definitely spent some time with Knight Rider. I remember watching, if I recall correctly, the pilot episode in a trailer we were living in at the time, in like 84, 83-ish, somewhere in there.
I was way too into Knight Rider and obsessed with the evil car and super pursuit mode and all that stuff. Absolutely.
Okay, but back to the comic book.
There we go. So back to the comic, Dan is looking pretty freaking awesome in his new tailored suit. He looks awesome. Sharon looks smoking hot in that red dress that just, woof, wow, got hot in here. And they're going off on their famous date. And I just think it is absolutely adorable to see them going on a date. It's nice to see superheroes with a public identity and someone who's visibly recognizable trying to go on a date. I just think it's fun.
I definitely associate Gil Kane a lot with Spider-Man because he had a nice little run in that, not about a decade earlier, actually, now to think about it, but I had access to those comics, and so I knew the Morbius stuff and all that kind of good things. And it's so nice to not have that Peter Parker moment where it's like, look, yes, I'm the Blue Devil. We're going out to dinner. Things are going to get weird. I hope you're all cool with that. Yes, I am. That's what makes Sharon the boss. And we just don't have to deal with any of the nonsense. It's like, look, I'm honest with you. There's none of this, you know, I've got a tummy ache. I've got to go fight the Scorpion. Stuff. I love that she's like, oh, okay, well, the Trickster's here. I guess we have to address this now. Sharon's the best.
She's pretty good. She's pretty good. And again, like you said, everything, I will just co-sign what you said about the public identity stuff. It makes the comic different and interesting.
And again, I'm sorry, Peter would have never rocked a suit as well as Dan does.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, Dan, because he's so blue and huge and ridiculous looking in the horns, the suit just looks that much cooler. Now, you talked about Gil Kane and like up the nose and stuff like that. He's also famous for showing the impact of superhero battles, and I missed it earlier, but there was a great panel with Trickster several pages back where he gets zapped by Bolt, and he's upside down, like these acrobatic moves from being zapped so hard, and that's just kind of what Gil Kane's trademarks as well, and we get to see it here.
Yo, yeah, definitely. Gil's one of those guys like Sal Buscema where, or I think that Rob was talking about the Jim Aparo punch recently on one of y'all shows. Mm-hmm. Just one of those people who can sell the impact, sell the action. You're not going to be bored reading a Gil Kane comic book as long as there's a fight sequence.
Absolutely.
And speaking of the fight sequences, we also have that great moment where he actually managed to jam Blue Beetle into the ceiling and he's sort of hanging from the horns for a moment there, which you've been waiting to have happen ever since the character was introduced. It's about time.
I absolutely adore. Or anytime they do something with his horns and sticking him in the ceiling is especially funny. So that really cracks me up. I adore it quite a bit. Now, by the way, on page 15 is the scene with I mentioned earlier where Trickster hits Bolt in the face with a cream pie and Bolt's word balloon literally looks like a water puddle. And it's just glorp or glub. So it was really clever on Bob LePan's part there.
Yeah, it's cool.
So we get to, when they first get to Chez Alphonse, I got to say, you know, they're getting ready to go in. And in the foreground, while they're talking to the maitre d', is one of the little people from Sword of the Atom. Okay, not really, but it's a Gil Kane drawn woman who's colored yellow, which makes me immediately think of those little people from Sword of the Atom. But that's just me.
Yeah, that was an interesting coloring choice. I was wondering about that myself. I'm just glad that there wasn't any ethnic quality to this person. She's a white.
Oh, jeez.
So you can go with Lathwin. You can say that it just has some weird nightclub lighting. We're not having to go anyplace else. She's evil Lynn. What's going on? Hey, by the way, did you see the trailer? Pretty cool.
Yeah, I did. It looks good. Yeah. But more importantly, on the facing page of the yellow person is another ad. What is it, Frank?
This is Saturday's The Place, where it's the CBS lineup, which is way less ambitious. We got like almost a literal comic strip for two pages. Well, it was a literal comic strip. And then this is just like a shot of Richard Pryor, who for some reason was hosting a children's show at this point, which never, the cognitive dissonance, even in 1984, Kitty Me was like, what's Richard Pryor doing before Kitty Me? I know what Richard Pryor does for a living. What's he doing here? I guess I saw the toy. Maybe it was where the lineup goes. But he's just like holding a box and all the new shows are popping out of the box.
Actually, I think he's holding a TV, maybe, but yeah.
Is it a TV? Wow.
I think so, okay. Yep.
He's working for a living then.
Yeah. So we've got, all right, well, I'll rattle them off. You say whether you watched them or not. Muppet Babies, I absolutely watched that religiously.
Love what about Muppet Babies. Well, still one of the best cartoons of all time, especially a kid's cartoon. And it holds up great.
Theme song lives rent-free in my head. Absolutely.
I had a podcast where I sang it, and everybody was singing along with me, apparently, based on the responses.
There you go. Get Along Gang, I was aware of it. Don't think I watched it much.
Yeah, it's a weird situation because I think, I know what it was. It was either an issue of Daredevil, the one where the little girl robots are roaming around him, or it was an issue from Secret Wars, because I know I cut up the Daredevil one to try to order some Secret Wars action figures that never happened. What I did do is cut the back cover of one of my comics to try to join the Get Along Gang, and they stiffed me. So I didn't get along with Frank, just like everybody else.
Wow, that's awful. Okay, I'm sorry that happened to you. I feel bad for you. Then we've got the Saturday Supercade, which was all about video games. And within that block, you'd have Q-Bert, Space Ace, Kangaroo, and Donkey Kong. Three of these properties were pretty popular. One of them, not so much.
Yeah, I have no memory of Kangaroo. And I think the first season had Frogger. And I remember Frogger. And I remember the Q-Bert cartoon because I was a big fan of that game. And then Space Ace, I remember more from watching watching it at the arcade because it was basically a cartoon.
Yeah.
Because the minute you tried to play it, you freaking died every time.
Absolutely.
And I wasn't King of Kong, but I was a pretty solid Donkey Kong player. So I was down for watching all those guys in cartoon form.
I actually didn't watch this much. I don't know if it's because I was devoted to the Pac-Man cartoon or what, but I remember I love the Q-Bert video game, so I watched the cartoon. I'm like, not for me. So I actually bailed on that pretty early. But of course, I did stick around for Dungeons and Dragons, as I'm sure most of us did.
Dungeons and Dragons was basically a superhero show, the way they set it up. And of course, Dungeons and Dragons had the lure because the majority of us would have a buddy who would get us to try to play the game. We'd spend 4 hours creating a character and then never actually do anything with that character. We always wanted to, though, and so we got to see these guys do the thing that we wanted to do.
Dude, that is exactly what happened to me.
That's what happened to everybody, my man.
I used to, I love this cartoon. I would go to the convenience store and I'd buy the candy, which came in this little box, like a nerd size box, but the candies were shaped like the characters. Like there was Avenger character, I don't know, whatever, but it's all these different characters, and I used to eat the crap out of those, very sugary based. And then I actually bought the DVD set when my kids were little and tried to get them to watch it, and they had no interest, which is ironic because my son grew up to be a D&D player, so he plays all the time now. But
that was the red cardboard box that those came in.
It was shaped like a nerd's box, so you know, it was those kind of like almost like a playing card size, but I can't remember what the box said.
My dude, it's a smaller version of the RPG box.
Was that what it was?
That's what it was, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Scaled down, yeah. So my gal's got that because she watched the show as a kid, too. She eventually grew up to become a D&D player thanks to COVID, and I've actually bought her several of these action figures because they're pretty cool-looking character designs.
That's awesome. And they had a cameo in the movie, too, by the way. So.
Oh, I love that. Oh, I saw that in the theaters. That was awesome. What was weird, though, is I was more excited for it than she was, and I think I enjoyed it more than she did.
It was fun. I enjoyed it. Then Pryor's Place, which is, again, the Richard Pryor show. I don't think I ever once watched that.
Like I said, it didn't make sense to me. And about once a year or two, the local TV channel, the syndicated channel, the UHF channel, would run a week of the Richard Pryor show because it only lasted something like 8 episodes or so. So they'd run like a 2-week block late at night. Having watched that, there was no way I was going to see this guy on the Saturday morning cartoon, and especially with some Chuck E. Cheese animatronics and such. No, that made no sense to me.
And the final cartoon is Pole Position. And I have to mention that. Not only does it live rent-free in my brain, I sing that song. Pole Position. I sing that quite frequently when I'm driving. I watched the cartoon, but the theme song is just absolutely on replay in my head every day.
I definitely watched the cartoon. I didn't know why it wasn't part of the Supercade, since that was also a video game.
Yeah.
But the theme song did not impregnate my brain for some reason. I know I watched the show plenty, but it just didn't land in there.
Sad part is I don't actually know all the words. So a lot of it is, you know, singing the word. Like, I'll sing a couple words and then it's like,
we all noticed. We caught that.
Yeah. It was pretty obvious. All right. Back to the comics. So Dan and Sharon are on the date. Bolt shows up in the restaurant causing havoc. And you get a lot of fun, chaotic stuff in here. Like I mentioned it in the recap, you know, Trickster jumps through a plate glass window. You know, he sets up a tripwire and trips Bolt. He throws an air conditioning, or how Trickster picked up an air conditioning unit, I don't know. But anyway, he picks up an air conditioning unit and throws it down on Bolt. You know, Blue Devil's flipping tables. They're having lots of fights. There's a lot of fun stuff here.
Yeah, again, you know, it's a Blue Devil comic.
Yeah.
Enough said.
Now, there is a little, I should have mentioned, there's more foreshadowing here, is that Trickster says Dan Cassidy's name, and Bolt thinks to himself, Dan Cassidy? So obviously, Bolt knows who Dan Cassidy is, which is foreshadowing for when they eventually reveal who Bolt actually is.
And, you know, I don't remember who Bolt actually is. I'm so used to him being the utility villain of the DC Universe that I don't even remember anymore.
He really is the utility villain of the... I mean, he was so perfectly generic and well-designed that he slotted into any book whenever they needed a mercenary. In fact, I think I've told you before, I used to do that on all my role-playing games. Like, I need a bad guy of the week. Throw Bolt in there. Why not? And he is such a great utility villain that he doesn't really need a backstory. He's just a hired mercenary assassin. It works perfect.
Well, so. And I looked at his comics Vine page just to see some reference, and he's been killed 3 times already, including twice in like a 2-year span, because they killed him in the Keith Giffen Suicide Squad run. They killed him in Terror Titans, and then they've recently killed him in one of the Suicide Squad volumes. So this, and I guarantee you he's going to come back from the dead regardless and get killed yet again.
Well, even when he was dead, they just replaced him with his son, who had the name, I think, Deathbolt or something like that. It was basically the same character. So it's just a good, iconic villain that was created here by Mishkin and Cohn in Paris, and it works well.
Well, and also he goes from Blue Devil to Captain Atom, another series I have a great passion for. So yeah, I can't help but love him by association.
There we go. Yeah. So there's a funny joke at the very end I really like when Dan is just had it. It's now Bolt does sort of disappear pretty quickly, so that Bolt has them cornered, but then splits because we're supposed to assume that he's run out of energy in his suit. But it is a little, maybe a little too convenient just so that they can get to the end of the comic, but you know, it's fine. But I do like how Dan is basically threatening Trickster, and Trickster says, okay, no rough stuff. It's no wonder you don't get many dates. That actually made me laugh out loud. I liked that.
So I guess that takes us into Speak of the Devil, and we're so into this book that we're reading the letters column 40-odd years later. One thing that's noted is that Paris is working on the Zero Man miniseries, and you're going to have to remind me, did we talk about that aborted miniseries on the show yet?
We did at one point, early on. We just mentioned it, that it was talked in the works, because it was going to be with Len Wein, if I remember right.
Because I've got Amazing Heroes that go into detail about what that book was going to be about, so if we haven't covered it in the past, we should probably cover it in the future. So something to look into.
Okay.
And then we also get a letter where they're complaining about how Blue Devil should have put up more of a fight against pre-crisis Superman. And man, I love that you love Blue Devil that much, but it's pre-crisis Superman, my dude.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Exactly.
And then there's another letter talking about how this was the comic that finally validated the guy's pre-existing love for Zatanna. Like, this was the one where he was like, I dig her, but I don't know why. And then he read Blue Devil and was like, that's why I love Zatanna. No kidding, kid.
Yeah, issue 4, decision made, right? Lifelong decisions made about Zatanna right then and there. I got to mention one in here. There is a letter in here by a guy named David Allen Wright, who wrote in, and I'll quote, Blue Devil is the Doctor Who of comics. Those who know what I'm talking about know what I'm talking about. Now, as somebody who frankly considers himself a bit of an expert in both Blue Devil and Doctor Who, I just got to say, huh? Like, I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, because it's quirky and funny? I mean, is he comparing the humor here to Tom Baker? I'm really not sure.
And I was going to ask you about that as the resident Doctor Who expert of the two people that are on this podcast. So I'm sorry. I know that the Have a Jelly Baby on Me is some reference to the guy that was around in the early 80s, right? The scarf guy?
Yeah, it was actually the 70s, but we got it in the 80s here in the States, yeah.
You're not going to correct me when I call him the scarf guy, really?
I mean, yes, I can tell you his name is Tom Baker. This is not a Doctor Who podcast, and I'm trying to keep that under control.
all I know is it was the show that my girlfriend would watch in this time period instead of hanging out with me. So, you know, I'm the one who lost out on that deal.
If you want me to admit, I am literally, as I'm talking to you, sitting next to a bookcase that has over 500 original Doctor Who novels in it that I've read almost all of. That's not fair. I probably read about 2/3 of them, but anyway.
And then you have the one letter that's written entirely in Zatanna backwards spellcasting, which would have given my buddy Billy Hines an aneurysm. But I was able to read it fine, although I have to say the conjunctions messed me up. Like, there shouldn't be apostrophes in a spell.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Well, if we're going to talk about the letters page, we also got to mention this is the first letters page since they've changed the name from Circuits and Sorcery to Speak of the Devil. So this is the new letter name, which is also, by coincidence, the name we use for our feedback section of the show.
And the devil apparently will not abide by panel barriers because the Speak of the is just blasting out of the space that's supposed to be allotted to it.
That is true. That is true.
It looks like it's trying to like make a pass at Jeanette Kahn and Dick Giordano. It's like he wants to take on the editorial suite or something.
Oh, my Lord. All right. Well, they do give you a preview of issue number 8 in there as well. Just a little bit of text. But I got to say, that is something to look forward to. Next issue, number 8, is so good that it actually appeared in the DC Digest Year's Best Comic Stories. So it's that good of a story. Or, you know, the irony is that cover shows Ambush Bug choosing the stories by throwing a dart. Maybe it really was chosen that way. I don't know. But anyway.
Well, and Giffen cover, and it's a Giffen issue. So maybe you had the inside track.
Oh, that could be true. That could be true.
But all right. This is going to be fun because this is Undiscovered Country. As much as I love Keith Giffen, I have never read this issue. I'm not even sure if I've flipped through this issue. So it's going to be completely new to me when we come back to do this, that next one.
It's a fun issue. It really is. And there's some cool stuff to talk about as far as the way it was written versus the way it came out. So
now before we finish up with this issue, though, I want to point out that Gil Kane is, you know, he was the funny guy back in the 70s and 80s, but he eventually became one of my all-time favorite comic book artists. I love Gil Kane.
Really? Okay.
But this issue was kind of a stumble on the road because I know you were saying that, oh, him playing it straight works. I don't actually think it does. I think that it's so straight that it quashes the comedy. It's like it's almost like they're running off two different tracks and the dialogue's trying to be light and Gil's just like, no, this is a serious action-oriented superhero comic book, and he just won't let that thing go. So what it reminded me of is one of my favorite musical acts is Depeche Mode, and they did an album of covers by different artists, and they've had beef for years with The Cure, but The Cure actually contributed a song to the covers album. They covered "Roll in My Eyes," which is a solid Depeche Mode song, not one of my favorites, but a major hit and you know, solid song. And I really don't like The Cure's version of the song because they just have different vibes, even though they're both, you know, like new wave acts, and they both are kind of dark wave. They both have like similar themes a lot of the time, but the vibes of Depeche Mode and Cure are just so different that as much as I love both bands, I don't really like it when one's dipping into the other's territory like they did there. And I'm having the same issue here. Is I have great affection for the issue. I kept looking at this cover for months because I left it out of my night drawer because I have both 6 and 7 in the same poly bag, so I just left it out. And I've been looking at this cover and loving this cover and have such warm, fuzzy feelings about it. And I still think it's a solid issue. It's a good issue. I enjoy it. It's just weird to me because Gil Kane doesn't belong on Blue Devil. As good as the book looks, he's just not the right dude for it. And what it also reminds me of is he did the 60s Plastic Man revival, and that didn't do too great. And I just don't think that Gil Kane's my guy when it comes to humor. He's so good at straight action that I think he kind of quashes the comedy.
I hear what you're saying. I think, you know, if someone were to ask me, is Gil Kane the guy for a Blue Devil book? No, he's absolutely not. But did Gil Kane do a very serviceable job for this issue? I think so. So I think you're right. I think he's not the guy for Blue Devil, but I think he did a pretty good job with what he was given. So
yeah, and again, I still enjoy the issue. It's just weird. It just doesn't feel quite right. But I'm glad he did the issue. It looks cool. It looks different. It looks interesting. But I'm really looking forward to Keith Giffen, who's another one of my all-time favorites.
You better strap in, because Giffen's also another weird-looking one. Like, I remember, like, the Gil Kane one did not stand out for me as much as the Keith Giffen one did for being strange when I was 12 years old, because as a 12-year-old kid, I'd never read a Keith Giffen comic, and so the art was really different for me. So, but
well, my favorite Keith Giffen is Jose Munoz period, and I know he's deep into that at this time period, so I even not having seen the book, I can definitely picture it in my mind, so I'm looking forward to him bringing his sauce to this.
Yeah, it'll be fun. But for now, we are going to get into the Weirdness Magnet Award, which is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something made us laugh, whatever it might be. Why don't you tell us your moment, Frank?
For me, it's the Planes, Trains, and Automobile moment where he can't operate the vehicle and everything's just coming apart in his hands. Even though I didn't even remember it exactly, if you're asking me to remember one thing from this issue, that was the one thing that would always pop into my mind, is him wrecking the car. So that's got to be my Weirdness Magnet moment.
All right. I really, really, really just want to pick the cover. I really do, because it's that good. But I feel like I should pick something from the inside, so I'm going to. I'm going to pick pages 14 and 15 when Dan's dressed up in the suit, Sharon first shows up there for their date, and they're both just so smitten with each other. I think it's adorable. I love seeing, you know, two people that are just so in love, and it makes me happy to see that. So there we go.
Yeah, the cover's wonderful, but it's one of those deals like when I do my alien show, I automatically disqualify the cover because it's just too easy. The fruit is hanging too low.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a wonderful cover. I love looking at this one.
Yep. Well, congratulations to both those moments. You have won a Weirdness Magnet Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for that moment. Now, we are going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we are going to cover your feedback from the last issue of Blue Devil.
Maybe I can do a podcast about comic books. No, everybody does a podcast about comic books. Maybe I can do a podcast about TV shows. Now, there's a lot of podcasts out there covering TV shows. I know, a podcast about movies. It's too general. A lot of people do podcasts about movies. Star Wars movies. No, everybody talks about Star Wars movies. Need to do a podcast that covers movies and television shows and comics and all the pop culture I loved growing up. Wait a minute. The Pop Culture Basement Podcast, hosted by me, Mike Jamison, covering all the pop culture that I consumed and that we consumed during our formative years. Now available on all reputable podcast platforms. Join us down in the basement.
Hi, I'm John Waters.
Hi, this is Dolph Lundgren.
Hi, I'm Lance Henriksen.
Hi, this is Keith Gordon.
Albert Kuhn.
Miguel Ferrer.
Nancy Allen.
Robert Davi.
Richard Elfman.
Ileana Douglas.
Patrick Warburton.
Wings Hauser.
Cliff DeYoung.
Steve Railsback.
Mr. D.
William Cass.
If you haven't been listening to the Projection Booth podcast, you're missing out. Each week, the Projection Booth brings you in-depth discussions of some of the most interesting movies ever made. I'm Mike White. No, the other one. I'm the guy who wrote the film fanzine Cashiers to Cinemart since 1994. Since early 2011, I've been co-hosting the Projection Booth podcast. Try us, won't you?
I never try anything. I just do it.
Visit the Projection Booth at projection-booth.com.
Welcome to Speak of the Devil, where we cover your feedback from the previous version. This is our own little version of the Blue Devil letter column, and we'll be getting into your feedback.
But my feedback is on the promo that we just ran.
Okay.
I've mostly just been putting out DC Secret Files in the past year, and I didn't want to just keep, you know, plugging my show over and over again. So I asked Shag to drop in one of my favorite podcasts, The Projection Booth. They just do a wonderful job of analyzing movies. They often will have celebrities come on and be interviewed by them, screenwriters, producers, sometimes really deep into the credits, but people who have interesting things to say about the movie. And then they're also, weirdly, I wouldn't necessarily want to do this, but they're doing a full critical evaluation of the movie. So if the movie's not good in their eyes, they're not going to hold back, even though they've got these interview segments. So I'm sure there's some people that like do the show once or like, I'm never doing that show again. But these guys once did a 6-hour podcast just for Conan the Barbarian. They will go so deep, and it's just such a joy if you're a movie fan. So I figured, you know, this is a show that I listen to on a regular basis. Let's give it a little bit of love on the show instead of throwing another blasted DC Secret Files promo at you.
Well, I love playing promos for other shows. So, in fact, folks at home, if you have a podcast and you have a promo and it's not in our shared folder, we have a Google shared drive where we all share promos with each other, let me know and we will get it played on some shows. But okay, so let's get into some feedback. So we're pulling our feedback from our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So if you want your feedback read on the air, please go there. And the first person whose feedback we're going to read is none other than Gary Cohn himself, co-creator of Blue Devil and co-writer of the very issue we just covered. So again, this is all feedback from Blue Devil number 6. Gary writes, Ernie Colon didn't just ink that book. A lot of the pencil work was his finishes over very rough Paris layouts. So there we go. That's interesting information that Ernie did a lot more of the lifting than we were led to believe. Now, I'll add, in the letters page we just covered in issue number 7, the editor actually adds to that. They reveal that Paris Colon's, well, first off, they said that it was his final issue and he couldn't take on a monthly book anymore. But it also reveals that Paris did just do the breakdowns. Ernie Colon did the finishes. Plus, there is some uncredited art assistance by Gary Martin last issue, which may explain why we felt like so much of that Blue Devil work still seemed on model, was Gary Martin was there doing some art assist.
I definitely felt Paris coming through more often sometimes than others. So maybe it was Gary coming to the rescue there.
It could be. Could be. So, and then Gary Cohn also shares that because we talked a lot about the two characters of Lenny and George. And we were debating, you know, about the Mice and Men and all that. So Gary confirms, yes, the Looney Tunes bits were also riffing off of Mice and Men, the 1940 version with Burgess Meredith and Lon Chaney Jr. So there we go. Heard it from the man himself. Awesome. All right, well, why don't you start us off with the next bit of feedback?
Well, speaking of another man, there's Keith G. Baker, who keeps threatening to get out some sports and comics materials for us. He should do like DC Dave and do like a little 7-minute podcast on the, you know, Florida Flamingos or whatever. But you do get to see his sports teams from the DC Universe in social media if you go looking for them. He wrote that he offered Nick Offerman would make a great Norm. And to that, I just say droll, troll, very droll, very troll.
I mean, to be fair, Nick Offerman is amazing, and I love him in a lot of things. I don't know if I'd put him as Norm, but he's still pretty great.
He'd probably be a decent jock, though.
Oh, he could. Oh, he absolutely would be a good jock. I don't know if he's got enough energy to be jock, though. Then Mark Baker Wright, who had your podcast called Not Your Father's Autobot Podcast and Black Rock's Toy Box, he says, it seems off topic talking about 1980s video gaming instead of Blue Devil properly, but you did ask. Which is a reference to Frank took us down a rabbit hole last episode talking about the Super Mario Brothers ads. So Mark shares quite a bit here. I'm just going to read bits and pieces of it. He says he did very much enjoy his family's Atari 2600 and later the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, back in the day. And then he talks a lot about Mario Brothers. But then I wonder at a particular thing he says. The other anecdote I have to share is about the Atari 2600 version of Mario Brothers actually came from another podcast. Gen X Grown Up featured Super Mario Brothers recently on the occasion of its 40th anniversary this year, but played this old commercial for Atari's Mario Brothers game, and the commercial parodies the classic sitcom Car 54 Where Are You, which I absolutely would not have known back in the 1980s, but I imagine some of the parents who would have been most likely to buy the games for their kids took notice. So I feel like that's interesting to sort of contrast with the conversation we had last time about how culture was different back when we were growing up and how there was only so many TV channels and so much media and that people all read the same classic books and things like that and maybe watched the same TV shows. And it is sort of interesting that Car 54 reference would have made sense with a lot of people. And nowadays, every media is so niche that, you know, you put a One Piece reference in there, only so many people are going to get it. Now, the other thing I want to mention is, you know, Mark references the Gen X Grown Up podcast, which is sort of crazy because I know those guys, like in real life. They are from my town. When I managed a comic shop in the 1990s, they both shopped at my comic book shop. And then we bumped into each other years later and they're like, you do a podcast? Wait, I do a podcast. We got talking and I bump into them every year at a local convention. So what a small world that Mark all the way out in LA was listening to a podcast that comes out of my area.
Man, Car 54, Where Are You? Captain Action, the Donna Reed, or sorry, the Patty Duke Show. We're just like so timely over here. We need to do My Mother the Car reference next.
We're going to start talking about George and Gracie soon. And I don't mean Star Trek.
Even the Looney Tunes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. All right.
Looney and George, yeah. And just a shout out to Mark Baker Wright. He was my co-host on the 6th episode of DC Secret Files. We covered the DC Universe Legacies number 2 and a bunch of Golden Age characters. So if you want to hear more from him, he's out there.
I know him too well. I don't want to hear more from him. I hang out with him at the Gallifrey One convention every year, so I'm just teasing.
And speaking of people we know well, Martin Gray of Too Dangerous for a Girl blog writes, what a treat to have a new episode of my favorite Blue Devil podcast. You know, could we try our FW Network manifest powers to get a DC's Finest collection of our Big Blue Boys book? It's nuts that these gems have never been collected. And the problem with that logic is that I'm the co-host and my rolled spine energy barely manifests podcast these days. I've probably been jinxing the Fire and Water rain dance for a Blue Devil collection. So that's on me. That's why that hasn't happened yet.
There was, years ago, they did, if I remember right, I think they solicited a showcase edition, which would have been those black and white phone books. But man, yeah, come on, give us a Finest for Blue Devil. It's so stinking good. People need to rediscover this book.
And again, Showcase presents black and white line work with the Gary Martin inking Paris Cullins. That would have been awesome, but yeah, it never happened.
Yeah.
So continuing with Martin, though, it was a shame not to have Gary Martin inking, but Ernie Colon, unsurprisingly, does a bang-up job. Incidentally, did you know Gary Martin moved the letters of his name around a tad, moved to the UK, and nah, forget it. Then again, check out the credits of issue number 13. So Martin's doing his own foreshadowing. This issue is just full of it.
Full of something.
He continues, count me in as a non-video game player. I've never tried anything since Benetone Tennis. It was too fast and intimidating for me. Shag! You never mentioned the argument-settling pics I tweeted regarding Stephanie Powers and James Garner. Honestly.
I'm pretty sure I did mention those last time, didn't I? Well, if I didn't, I apologize, Martin.
Frank's comments on the loss of the shared canon was the smartest thing I've heard on a podcast in ages. Thank you. It's a rotten shame books don't get the love they once did. Here in Scotland, kids can graduate high school these days without having ever read a novel, never mind a Scottish one. And Chad, don't undersell yourself for enjoying Doctor Who books, etc. We got around to that eventually.
We did.
And you can take solace. At least a Scottish student will be capable of reading at graduation. We don't have that guarantee here.
That's pretty true.
Finally, a young Alan Tudyk would likely make a great trickster, as boringly obvious as that is. And, you know, you can't go wrong with Tudyk, but he's no Nick Offerman, right, Keith?
You're going to keep trolling Keith, aren't you? When I read his comment and he said Alan Tudyk as the trickster, my mind practically exploded. I'm like, oh my gosh, that is honestly the best casting for the Trickster ever. Alan Tudyk would have been a perfect Trickster.
You've got somebody else in mind, I'm sure, though.
I do. Because, you know me, I stick to the 80s. But if I was doing modern day, Alan Tudyk absolutely would be great for it.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, again, he's great in most things. So, yeah, especially anything comedic.
That is true. Then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, for Norm, Robin Williams from the Mork and Mindy era would be good. Or for the Trickster, Andy Kaufman. And he says, I picked Robin Williams for Norm because he can be the goofy guy and the action guy. And for Andy Kaufman, for the Trickster, he was someone who always wanted to play the bad guy, and he did one time in Memphis Wrestling, and he was really good at it. I think he would have thoroughly enjoyed and respect and bring a new style to the character. Interesting. Robin Williams would have been sort of a fun sort of idea. I almost could see Robin Williams as the Trickster, honestly, rather than Andy Kaufman. That could have actually worked. But either way, thank you, Bucky, for contributing. I appreciate that. I love loving the casting couch suggestions, y'all. We're going to have a new one for you in just a minute. But yeah, keep them coming.
Nate the Great writes, for Norm casting, Kenan Thompson, since you already picked Little Rel, I'm going a little different here. For Trickster, Sean William Scott. Guys, where are your Zatanna picks? By the way, Shag, thanks for mentioning Peter David's Hulk Joe Fix-It stuff. It has somehow become way underrated. Yeah, no kidding. I plan on soliciting Zatanna fan casting ahead of her, sadly, final appearance in the book with number 13, unless we forget.
Oh, okay, there we go.
And yeah, I got to co-sign on Kenan Thompson, too. That's another great choice. And he's an SNL legend at this point. We're probably not going to stray too far from those grounds.
Yeah, I noticed some of your upcoming picks. There's a lot of SNL in there. They were from Doug Adamson from the Monitor Tapes, A Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast. He says, my casting suggestion for Norm, and maybe it's a bit out there, but Idris Elba. I know he's probably too big a name for the role, but it's fan casting. Idris Elba, as we know, has some acting and some action chops, and I think having him cameo in the Blue Devil film would be right up his alley. Maybe? I don't know that I've seen Idris do comedy, so I don't know. I assume he can. The man's an incredibly versatile actor, but he might be a little too cool, actually, for Norm. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm going to tend to agree with that, but my other issue is that I've got a thing where I really don't like casting people that have already played comic book characters, and he's Bloodsport.
Okay. I mean, that's a weird thing to get hung up on, but then again, you're you, so that's okay.
He led the Suicide Squad. He was literally the star of the sequel.
I know. I watched the movie. It was good. You mean he was Deadshot, and then they changed their name when Will Smith got mad? So
yeah, no dispute.
Then Doug Adamson continues. He goes, this episode is actually fan casting the Trickster, and while if we are in the 1980s, Mark Hamill is perfect casting. Agree to disagree, Doug. And he goes on to say, for the modern...
I think that's a typical Doug Adamson gag.
That could be. Modern...
Mark Hamill was...
Could you shut up? You just never stop talking. Oh, my God. So for the modern era, it gets more tricky. There's a lot of trick in here. He's playing the word games because it's Doug. For the modern era, it gets more tricky. The trick is casting James Jesse is that you want someone charming enough to be a con man, but at the same time, smart enough to build the tricks he uses. My default for this would likely be Alan Tudyk. So that's a second vote for Alan Tudyk. And yeah, guys, I don't know that my pick's going to be better than that, but there we go. Good call, Doug. Now you may speak, Frank. What did you want to obnoxiously say?
Mark Hamill played the Trickster in the Flash TV show, man.
And I'm not a fan.
But the point was he was jabbing you, dude.
I know. I figured somebody would... I mean, was that him coming at me, bro? Because, like, I expected to get a lot of heat for that comment on saying that, but I think I came through fairly unscathed. But it is now time for the casting couch. And yes, we are going to cast the Trickster. Previously, we have casted Dan Cassidy, Marla Bloom, Wayne Tarrant, Sharon Scott, Neboros, and Norm. And now, again, we're going to do James Jesse. So, who's going first? You or me here?
Well, you're the one who kept your secret, so I figure you must be keeping something close to the vest.
I never put mine in. I never tell you till we get to the recording.
Okay. So here's the thing. You know, I've mine has been the more budget-friendly and more modern movie. And I've picked, you know, a number of actors that are a little long in the tooth, but I think people that could still do superhero stuff. I mean, you know, Robert Downey Jr. started at 50, so that's kind of a good line in the sand, for instance. I thought that, well, you know, I've got an SNL alum as the star, Bill Hader, and it'd be kind of cool to get somebody who was part of his class, you know, right? That somebody who came up alongside him. So the first person I had in mind, almost the entire time was Will Forte, except Will Forte is pushing 60. And I think that's a little much to ask of him at this point. So I'm going to be a slightly more realistic going into somebody in the mid 40s. I went with Mikey Day, also from Saturday Night Live. Typically, he tends to play dumber type characters. He's, you know, he's that's... not the only thing he's capable of doing, though. Like, I don't know, for instance, Ariana Grande music video went viral where he was the serial killer dad. I think that he has a little bit more range than he's given credit for. Plus, he's in really good shape for his age. And I just think he played pretty well off of My Blue Devil. So I'm not going to say he's in the Alan Tudyk class, but Tudyk's also pushing 60, so he wouldn't have fit my criteria anyway.
Yeah, he's pretty good. I looked him up and I was like, oh, okay, I know this guy. I've seen him a lot of stuff. So that's a pretty good, pretty decent pick. For me, my criteria, you know, I'm going to lean into the 80s. It's just what I do. And I my criteria is, all right, he's got to be kind of handsome. Doesn't have to be incredibly gorgeous, but kind of handsome. He's got to have cool, floopy blue hair and blonde hair, because I think that's one of the things that looks so good when Paris Collins draws the Trickster with just lots of floppy hair. And he's got to be in pretty good physical shape, because, you know, the Trickster's doing a lot of stuff. So the first, and this is not my pick, I'll get to my pick last, but the people I considered strongly were Val Kilmer during, like, the Real Genius and Top Secret era. You know, that he would have been pretty good. He's got the hair for it. He's got, you know, kind of handsome, action-oriented, could have worked. Anthony Michael Hall during the Weird Science era. He's got kind of the gawky nerdiness going, but he definitely had the hair during Weird Science, and he has kind of that cool look. Then William Zabka, who was Johnny in Karate Kid and then in Cobra Kai. When he was young, he could have possibly pulled it off. I mean, he actually looks a little bit like the Gil Kane Trickster, actually, William Zabka. But my ultimate pick is Cary Elles from the Princess Bride era. He's handsome. He's physically fit. He's got great blonde hair. He's got good comedic timing. But he can also play the kind of down on his luck version of Trickster that you really need for the Blue Devil book. So there we go. Cary Elles is my pick, sir.
Yeah, and Cary Elles is a good pick. I got no problem with him either, especially in period, because I'm sorry, some of those guys were too cool for the Trickster. Maybe the Gil Kane Trickster from this issue, sure. and of course, one of those guys was a Batman, so he's disqualified by, but yeah, Cary Elles, I don't think he ever did a superhero thing. He's handsome. You can believe him as being kind of a smooth talker, a bit of a con man. Yeah, worked great. I prefer your 80s pick to my modern pick, but I think they're both pretty solid.
And I think they both lose to Alan Tudyk, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's fair.
So Frank, who's next for the casting couch? Who should the folks at home be brainstorming?
Well, I mean, you know, Bolt's right there. Why don't we, right?
Oh, I mean, there's not much to him, though. So I guess you can kind of go any way you want with it, folks.
Well, I mean, I've read a few more Bolt comics, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, so you've got the sneer, you've got the, you know, the anger, you've got the action oriented, you've got, you know, I don't even remember what he looks like without his mask. I'm trying to remember the guy's real name. I can't remember it now either. So yeah, we'll do Bolt. It'll be fun. So there we go, folks. Be thinking about it. Throw in the comments, share your thoughts on Bolt, and maybe you'll all give us a V8 moment like you did with Alan Tudyk, and we'll be like, man, that's who we should have cast. Well, Frank, thank you again for joining me on this journey to celebrate Blue Devil. It's always so much fun, buddy. I appreciate it.
It's always a blast. I would miss it so much if I didn't have it. So, you know, every few months when we do this, it makes my day.
Well, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you, sir?
Well, I'm mostly just doing the DC Secret Files podcast once a month-ish, but my brother's recently recorded an episode on Dark Knight Returns for our DC special podcast, and we're hopefully going to do several more like it to cover the 40th anniversaries of other books that made 1986 one of the greatest years in comics history. We'll see how that works out. But for now, Dark Knight Returns is actually out there on the interwebs if you want to listen to it.
So you're going
to
do a special on, like, the Madballs comic?
That was, I think, 87. So,
darn it!
Missed the deadline.
I was just throwing it out there to see if it landed. Guess apparently it didn't. Oh, well.
Well, in Star Comics, it really was. My brother bought that book.
Just, it didn't land, just like the toys didn't. But anyway, thank you, Frank. I really appreciate it. And folks, while I love talking about Blue Devil, next episode we will be tackling a different topic. But don't worry, we'll get back to Blue Devil coverage in the coming months. And what will that topic be next episode? Sorry, folks. You're just going to have to wait and find out. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Frank.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy.